Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hey, everyone. Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. I am talking today with Richard Parker. Richard, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm really good. Whereabouts are you in the world, in this world of ours?
In this world of ours, I'm in Southeast Florida. Actually, the city that I live in, my office is in Boca Raton, Florida, which is between Miami and West Palm on the East Coast.
Right. Florida. East Coast. Nice weather?
Always nice.
That's the thing. That's probably one of the we were talking before about like things that you hear with the people actually on the ground like you, but that's like the cliched thing that all us people in Australia, when they think of places like Florida, think of. So I'm glad it's true.
It is true. And my wife is from Melbourne, so she always tells me, you know, Melbourne, you could have four seasons in one day.
And that's true. But every single time I've been to Melbourne, it's been boiling hot. It's never been that. So I've never experienced that.
Yeah. When I was there a few times, I mean, I love it there. It's one of my favorite cities. I love Australia, but Melbourne especially because it's more like a village. But yeah, it was a little cold. I was there in September and I didn't even think about it when I first went over. And I was like, I didn't bring even a sweater. I had to wear my late father-in-law's leather bomber jacket. I'm 5'8" on a good day, 160 pounds, and he was 6'3", 235. So you could imagine what I looked like, right? I guess probably some people were coming up to me thought I was homeless, but it was pretty darn cold.
But at least you were warm.
I was really toasty.
That's great to hear. So so for people who don't know about you, Richard, would you be so kind as to just give people like a bit of an overview and a sort of a short annotated history about what you do, I guess, and then we'll get into some of the, you know, substantial parts of the topics we're going to talk about today.
Perfect. I'm happy to. And I'll avoid the long, boring version because we don't want to put your listeners to sleep. And so I've been in the world of mergers and acquisitions, which is a very fancy title for buying and selling businesses, for 34 years on all aspects. As a buyer, I've purchased 14 companies, which includes one co-invest. And those are from what we call Main Street USA businesses. Purchased for $50,000 right up to a co-investment that was a little over $200 million. And my professional career is really buying and selling businesses. I worked as a buyer advisor, seller side advisor, and an investor myself. And going back to a number of years ago, I was involved in a transaction after I'd moved from Canada to Florida. I've been living here for 28 years. I grew up in Montreal. And I became involved in a transaction that went sideways. I started uncovering a lot of problems that were really – they would have not been evident to someone who didn't have my level of experience. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I've been just doing this a long time and recognized some real issues and decided to walk away from the deal. And there was no question in my mind the average person would have bought that business and had a real disaster on their hands. And that became the impetus for me to really study what goes on in the world of buying and selling businesses for individuals, not for big institutional buyers, but the average person looking to acquire a business to change their life, improve their financial situation, build some value, and recognize that there are really no valuable resources for people, either advisor wise or material. And I spent a year researching the market and winded up deciding that I was going to put my years of experience into a course to help people with the only agenda to help people. I never even thought it was going to turn into a business. I was just really fascinated with this world. I know the impact it's had on me, my life. I come from a lower middle class background, never went to college, and I see how blessed I've been in my career, the level of enjoyment and financially as well, and said, you know, I want to be able to share that with people. And put it into a course without expectations. Like, I was happy to sell one. If I sold one and helped one person buy the right business or avoid buying the wrong one, it would have been enough for me. And here we are a number of years later. We've sold 100,000 of these and helped tens of thousands of people in about 80 countries buy businesses. So that's That's where I spend my days. And I spend my days on the phone and on email helping people and on podcasts, trying to spread the word of, you know, if you do this the right way, it can have a magnificent impact on your life.
Yeah, I think that's marvelous, Richard. I think it's, it seems to be one of those universal truths, doesn't it? That like, you know, if you do actually just help without the expectation of receiving something back, you know, eventually at some point, you know, it's, I'm sure like a lot of people out there are probably listening going, oh, that's, you know, it's sort of in the realm of a cliche, but I think it's really true. And I think certainly, cause I was going to then ask a little bit further down, but you sort of answered, some of this particular question, which was, about, I guess, how you got into this, well, or more why, but I can see it seems very, very obvious to me that it's sort of something that brings you joy too. Is that right? Like it brings you happiness to do this?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great level of gratification. And I've bought a number of businesses, but nothing compares to the enjoyment that I get when I help somebody. And I understand people could say, I think, you know, that's, you know, I could understand someone listening and say, well, it's, you know, you're very politically incorrect in Australia. So I could share this with you. And someone could say, oh, it sounds like bullshit. You know, it's like, you know, everybody's pleading the same case, but you know, I don't have to defend it to anybody because I know it's true. And that was my only agenda going into it. And so, whether or not people want to, people have their own interpretation, I don't have to answer to them. I know where, from where I operate. And it's been, you know, I've had some great financial success in business, great personal relationship success with employees and growing businesses. And that's always been very exciting. And I enjoy that. I enjoy it immensely. That whole hunt and the journey to acquire a business and grow something. But I could tell you that nothing has given me the level of gratification that's comes from being able to help people, because then you really do what you do and love what you do, and you're able to multiply it. And so for me, it's just incredible feedback to be able to help people in something that I really love. So I get to do what I love every day on this grand scale with others and bring them into the fold. So for me, it's really, 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 really gratifying. I mean, it's like, it's hard for me to even express how much enjoyment I get from it.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet. I mean, I can imagine there's a very big element too, like you were sort of hinting at before about that, the hunt, like the process, like I've been, I guess, you know, fortunate, although I don't think I thought it at the time, to buy another business, which like for us, it was, this was like a long time ago, and it was purely at a time where we just thought we needed to expedite and grow our, you know, what we wanted to do. And we thought a good, I mean, we didn't know, we had no idea whether that was, you know, like, I'm sure you've heard it like a million times. We were like, well, buy a business. Yeah. I think it was, I can't remember. There was a bunch of other options. Like we'd get a loan or, you know, do this. Yeah. Like we didn't know. This was like however many years ago, like a long time ago. And we bought this other business and looked around, and fortunately, you know, thank our lucky stars, we found one that was good. The person that we, bought it from was wonderful. And we got on really well, and she was very helpful. This was like, you know, a design business like ours, but a bigger one that had more income. And that was a good experience. So, I mean, I think we just kind of got lucky too, maybe, but, and I mean, just knowing zero, but it's interesting because when you got in contact and it was about, you know, what we're talking about, I was like, I automatically, for me, all these memories started like flooding back about like that was like the first thing that happened to me wasn't like anything else, but all the memories that I had probably partially forgotten about what had happened and how we did it. And then we're like, oh, how we get the money to even do that? I mean, it wasn't huge. It was, you know, and all these memories and the process. And the biggest thing was how, when we happened and we felt that we leveled up in a design business, of how much of a newbie I felt. Like the biggest newbie in the world. In fact, I can't really remember a time where I'd felt more like a newbie, even though before we bought it, I thought I was pretty good, you know, pretty good at stuff. And, But and like, man, I tell you, and then there's these different levels you go through. I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this when in life where you go, yeah, I'm at point A and you think I'm pretty good and you don't have enough to compare with to know otherwise. Then you hit this other level and you go, man, was I wrong? I was really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, really, absolutely.
And then, yeah. And then you hit another level. But, I guess, could you sort of speak to, even if you've got some sort of stories about people who you've helped buy a business, and the kind of impact that it's actually had on them for what they were trying to do, like the reasons why they bought the business in the first place?
Sure. So I'm happy to answer that and certainly don't want it to sound like a testimonial. So I'll talk to you about a couple of – I just got off the phone actually with a gentleman by the name of Mike Miller, and Mike has a company that's now called Regenerative Capital Group based in Canada, and he's underwriting 5 aspiring entrepreneurs to acquire businesses. He's covering the entire cost out of the gate. They had 172 applicants. And the story of Mike is he and I met a number of years ago, him and his partner, Iggy Domagowski. They actually bought my course a number of years ago, started buying some smaller businesses. Great guys, really, really good chefs, really a lot of fun and very well-grounded guys. And really just, they're both Canadian. So, you know, Canadians like Australians, very, just very nice, very, very nice people. And started smaller businesses and aggregated them and built them up. They ended up building up that group to $200 million in revenue and sold their company for $100 million. And Mike just had me on a call because they asked me to be on their advisory board to help these 5 people acquire businesses. And they actually flew me out to Mexico. I did all the educational component. And so that story, like Iggy joined Mike and became a multimillionaire as a result of it. So that's certainly one that comes to mind, especially, and it always comes to mind because he's a really good guy, really good guys. And there's another individual who actually have both of their a video that I did with them not too long ago, Don Wilson. He was a guy in the financial business. He bought a small company, invested $30,000, bought a candy store and for him and his wife and started buying, recognized there's an opportunity, bought a couple other ones and a couple other ones. And then he started getting into another business and bought a couple other business. And he ended up selling out for about $6 million and retired to Florida. And I have another client in the engineering business, this guy, Gary Elswig, who bought my material, then ended up hiring me. And we became very, very fast, fun friends together and built up a bunch of businesses. I mean, I ran out of room in my garage with binders full of testimonials. So there's a lot of them. And I don't want it to sound like an infomercial. So I guess in part of the answer to your question is the ones that have really seems like that have always really resonated me because you have those stories of those 3 that have had uber success, right? Like this, not good success, like massive success. And it's very easy to tell those stories. But the other stories, the size that I really like are the individuals who were working at a job or had lost a job and they were looking to either generate an income or replace an income. And really had hoped and very often didn't have the confidence to even do this because a lot of people really think they look at this and say, oh, you know, buying businesses, that's for big companies, right? That doesn't happen for the little guy. And it really does. And so when I see people gain the confidence that they can do this because it is doable. I mean, it's not difficult. It's just complex. I mean, you got lucky. The best thing that you said about your acquisition is you happened to be dealing with a seller you got on well with. They were probably, was probably honest. She wanted to see you successful. Her heart was in the right place, wanted to turn over the business to the right folks to continue her legacy. So the personal connection allowed you to screw up a couple of other things. Like if you did it now and you know so much more now, you'd probably look at it, you may have some trepidation, but there was a high element of trust and like, and that allowed you to get through the process in a good way and tell people that, you know, having that with a seller is so important because you're relying on them for information for a transition. You want to uncover some of the issues related to a business. So this is when people can gain that confidence that they can do this. It's a beautiful thing that someone who at one point was thinking, geez, I'm going to spend the next 25 years working at this company, making a decent living. And I hate what I do because most people can't, you know, really don't like it. And here there's an opportunity to get into something where you really feel better about yourself. Not only is never mind the financial part is great, But it's all the other things that you just feel good about what you do every day. And you're building something and contributing to the life of others and empowering employees. So, you know, those are the stories that I love. I mean, I love the person who bought the dry cleaner, you know, and then before you know it has six or seven locations, you know, and the person who bought a small moving and storage business that I helped them acquire. And they were doing, you know, $1.5 million and then they're doing 10, you know, a few years later. And like you see that. They're a different human being because they feel so good about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, I very strongly relate to a few things you were saying, especially the part, and this relates like to our purchase again, too, is that we actually even had, which was the sort of a joint idea to have a, I guess like a welcoming party event for, which was with the some of the major clients that, the person selling the business had to introduce to us and for us to all meet and just have a nice time and transition over and just talk. So she could personally, which I thought was kind of incredible. That was her idea.
Great idea.
And then
great
we, idea. Because like for her too, because she, stoic. Yeah, that's right. I mean, she was going to a different stage in her life, but she ended up, she was still a designer. And so she, but she didn't want to run her own business anymore. She just didn't want to do it. She was just like, I don't want it, just too stressful, too much, whatever. She just wanted to, I think freelance and, but I think she was working for somebody else and she had some offer. So she took it up, but it was still really important to her because she still had sort of contact. And, you know, the world is a small place. Like this was on, I mean, the Gold Coast, where the business was. And she wanted to ensure, like for herself, but mainly for us, that the transition was as good as it could be and that she would, you know, impart this wonderful trust that she had built up with us in a short time, which I just thought was just so generous. Like she didn't have to do any of that, but she did. And that, that was like, I think we certainly valued it a lot at the time, but I think even in retrospect now, I value it even more. And I'm like,
absolutely.
That the advantage that had, like you were saying, for your confidence too, was huge because especially at the time, like I said before, I felt like such a newbie. And even though I didn't think I was a newbie, I thought I was, you know, I thought I was an expert in this and that. And I clearly wasn't, you know, and I'm still not an expert. I'm better at things than I was, that's for sure. But it's actually, I often think back and I'm sure, I mean, maybe you can speak to this too about people that you've met who say if they're in a certain industry that the business requires them to have a certain skill set, how much they have perhaps like some years later and when you've seen them again sort of improve not only in just general confidence but like the act of buying a business and doing that, how much that has just improved, you know, skills, life, and other things. Can you think of like any experiences like that where people have sort of transformed?
Yes. So it's a great question. And your story, I love your story because it, even though you readily admit you didn't know what the heck you were doing, you actually did a deal with the right person. And you play a role as well because you didn't go in there, as we say here, guns a-blazing, trying to point out everything that was wrong with their business and, you know, try to put together a deal that was, you know, only favorable to you. It was probably a real nice, meaningful and thoughtful process that you enjoyed with each other and got to know each other. And that's why this individual happens to be obviously a very kind lady, made sure that the transition to new people and having that party, that type of stuff, she wanted to do it because there's still, you know, it's still her legacy and she took a long time to build up those clients and wanted to see a transition. Well, if you screwed it up after, that's your problem. But she wanted to make sure she did everything she can to put it into
exactly into
good hands. And so the point you brought up related to how people learn an industry and the skill set and what have you, it brings up a really important point in this whole process. You know, you say process in the Australia, so I'll do my best, but the whole process, right? Which again, I know because of Canada and what have
you. That's right. That's right, Richard. That's the right way to say it.
In Canada, it's a process. Yeah, like my wife and I get into this conversation all the time. I'm Canadian, she's Australian, and we talk about it all the time with our American friends. Say, you don't understand something. The language in the United States is American. It's not English, right? You guys don't speak English. You speak right. American, right? You're both sticklers for that. So, but, you know, I just out of habit, I'll still use process. But
yeah.
So one of the big things that people need to consider, and this really – I think causes a lot of heartburn for people if they're going to decide to make this decision to do something is don't confuse expertise with experience. And then I want people to think about that for a second. I want to park that. I want to park that for a second. And with that in mind, because the most important thing in this entire journey, in this process, is to make sure that you acquire a business that matches perfectly to your skill set. Whatever it is that you do best has to be the single most important driving factor of the revenue and profits of any business you consider purchasing, because you're generally taking the place of an owner operator for anything else you can hire. So what the tendency of people is to do is say, well, you know, I've always worked in healthcare, or always worked in design work, or I always worked in commercial cleaning business or whatever. So I have to buy a business in that industry. And that's not right. That's blatantly wrong. You don't have to buy a business in the same industry, because it's pretty, unless it's overly complicated, it's much easier to learn an industry versus learning a skill set. Whatever it is that your superpower is, as far as a skill set is, that's what's needed for the business. That's what you got to match, because you could learn an industry. So not confusing expertise with experience is really, really important. And what you find is, unless a business is overly complicated, and tell people, look, if you can't explain the business quickly in one sentence, when people ask you what type of business you think of buying, you probably shouldn't buy it, because it's too complicated. If it's too complicated to explain, it's probably too complicated to own. But as long as you bring your best skill set, the industry and people, what I find is that if you have this great skill set, and everybody has one, it could be sales, marketing, operations, logistics, putting a plan together, whatever the application of technology to a business, everybody has one skill set above the other. And so people learn industries quickly, and it's incredible to watch people's excitement where they learn a little bit about it before they acquire it, then they buy it. And as long as it's the right business, now they're totally immersed, right? At the beginning, you're like keeping one nostril barely above the water, right? Because it's just like this onslaught of information. Everything's new. And so, but in no short order, when I go back and, you know, when you speak to these people 3 months, 6 months, a year or two later, it's amazing how well-versed they are in the industry. And it's like, it's fascinating to watch the evolution.
Yeah, I bet. I can't imagine. Well, I sort of can, but I with the range of different sorts of businesses that you must have spoken to people about, because I can imagine, because I think in some way it's the same enjoyment that and probably fascination more than anything that I have every single time, you know, a client of ours comes to us and says, I work in this industry. I'm like, I didn't even know that industry existed. That's wild.
Wild, right?
You do what? And then it's my job, like, to either, you know, like build a website or create a brand. And I find that really fascinating, because I have to sort of dive into this other world in this funny way. Like, I do it in a sort of semi-superficial way, but then there's certain parts where I actually really have to know stuff, and I find that incredibly interesting. So, you know, people are very adaptable, really, aren't they? Like, people, they you know, get, and this is also just from personal experience, I, you know, flashing back to me being a newbie and going, because it was a very print orientated, this business we bought, it was a very print orientated design agency. There wasn't many digital services being offered. And so the interesting conversation that we car does buyer and seller was that what we were going to be able to bring to the table for her existing clients that were going to become ours was that we had more strength, but the dial was sort of shifted differently. Our emphasis was still on print, but more digital. And so she had, like, we both recognized this, but I remember distinctly her bringing it up and going, this is going to be great for, like, her perspective was, which I also in retrospect more is like, wow, that was really wonderful. But she was like, this is going to be great for these clients because you're going to be able to now offer, you know, this suite of services that I can, like, sort of offer, but I'm not very good at it. And you're, like, quite good at that. And I'm better at this. And so she had this perspective of, oh, this is a value add, not just like, you know, some other, this is a transaction. Her whole thing was, yeah, obviously her moving on in a different way, but it was more so, I'm going to help you do it. I'm going to make sure her and her partner at the time made up like this manual for me that had like every bit of information they could possibly cram into it about processes and everything that was really quite comprehensive. And I was like, whoa, this is so, still wasn't easy. It was still really hard. Yeah, but at least I had this is like, well, I needed to know how to log into this. This is all this stuff, which they didn't have to be prompted to do or anything. They were just like, did it. And so
yeah, they're just being good about it. Yep.
Yeah. No.
You know,
so
one thing I'll tell you is, you know, you happen to luck into the one seller on the planet who would do something that nice. Because, you know, I'm not trying to be negative, but that's a beautiful situation. And really, wow. It was, over the top kind. And most sellers, as long as you maintain that good relationship during the discussions, negotiations, the closing, they'll be certainly very helpful. But that particular individual went above and beyond the call of duty to really make sure that they provided you with a platform to be successful. They really wanted you to be successful. That's wonderful. I mean, you really got lucky. And also, you know, being able to have that is a big reason for your ultimate success after that. Similarly, you know, when people acquire businesses, they don't always have that luxury, and the seller may not be as helpful. They may not be detrimental, but they're not going to be as helpful. And so it's very important for people when they buy a business that the first few months, you know, you got to shut up and listen and observe, because you don't know anything. You're dumb shit at that point. You know, this is a new industry, new business. I mean, you go in the first day, you don't even know how to turn on the coffee machine, right? So you have to learn everything, and hopefully have a good seller to help with your transition. But that process to me, in you know, plays to the first part of your question, which is, even though it may seem daunting at the beginning, because, you know, you may look for business, you didn't even know those businesses existed, as you said. For me, that's I get my jollies from that stuff. That's what turns my crank. Okay. That the idea that
I can see that, Richard. Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, I like to think that I'm not intellectual, but I'm intellectually curious. And to me, I wake up on a Tuesday and I'm going to find a new business that I didn't even know exist when I got up in the morning, and I'll get into conversation with someone who may ultimately acquire that business. And I've got to learn that business intimately. I find that fascinating. Like, the learning process to me is very, very exciting. The uncertainty that happens during various stages of the process, you just learn to embrace the uncertainty. You're going to work your way through it. You're not going to put yourself, if you're educated and learn how to do this in a good way, you won't put yourself into a position of risk, because you could really mitigate most, if not all, of the risk. If you know what the heck you're doing, you do this in a good way. I mean, that's what I stand for, of course. And going through this, the other thing that's really, really cool about all of this, you go down the road with a particular business, you've learned an immense amount about it. For whatever reason, you decide not to buy it, whatever that reason may be, it's amazing how much of that learning you can adopt to the next opportunity. About how you go about your research, how you go about your conversation, things that you should be negotiating, stuff that may, you know, how do you uncover a seller's hot buttons? How do you uncover, you know, or how do you deal with what I call the bee in the bonnet syndrome, because everybody, if you get to a point in these transactions where everybody gets completely whacked out nuts about one particular point that defies logic, it defies rationale. And when someone is illogical or irrational, you can't be logical or rational. I mean, you just, sometimes you just got to let it sit, simmer and find its way or disappear. Or sometimes you just got to deal with it in the best way possible. But those type of things, to me, that's what makes this whole thing really, really exciting. Like all those moving parts and again, the embracing of the uncertainty, because you get excited. And, you know, I tell my clients the two emotions that you should have during this process is you should have a healthy combination of excitement and fear, because the excitement keeps you going. The fear keeps you diligent. And so if you could balance those out, it ultimately allows you to look at things from the right lens most of the time. Not always, but I mean, there's, you can't solve for everything, but if you look at it from those lenses, through those two potential lenses, and also understand that those feelings are normal, right? I mean, that's a big part
exactly.
of it.
Exactly.
You know, to really understand that, then you can navigate it. Cause again, it's not a difficult process, just complex. There's a lot of moving parts. And that's, for me, it's, when I went into this, is how do I take this really complex thing and reduce it to bite-sized pieces? I mean, that was really the base of everything that I wanted to accomplish for people. Take something really hard. It's like, I don't know if you've ever put together a propane barbecue. I don't eat meat anymore, but I haven't done it in years. But you know, you get, I put together a bunch of them, probably four or five of them. And you get this thing and you open up all the packages with parts and it seems like there's a billion of them. And you have the picture on the cover of the box that offers you no help. But if you lay them out and you go through the instructions and do it step by step in an organized fashion. And you don't get upset and throw away a couple of parts because you're pissed off you can't put something together. But if you do it in a methodical way in bite-sized pieces, at the end, you have your project done.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to buying a business. It's the mirror image of that thought process.
Exactly right. I was just looking, I want to be able to build a deck or build things. And I built like a few things. And I decided, because it seemed, I'd watched this, we've got this house and we've got some things being built. And I know, like, when you break, same thing, like you break it down and I know it's actually probably in one sense, it's actually simpler than probably the propane barbecue. There's probably less things to do, but things seem daunting, don't they? In your mind, like an idea builds in your mind and that idea can become, you know, like outlandish and ridiculous, which I guess is like I often find I have a constant sort of internal struggle, which I probably always have, I'm sure, where you don't want to do something and procrastination kicks in. But I know from past experience that as soon as I start it, it'll be fine. There won't be a problem. I know that. And that's even in my head when I'm procrastinating. And I
that's what makes it even crazier. Yes.
It's kind of annoying. And it's like the other part of me is going, dude, like, what are you doing? You know, it's going to be fine. You just have to start. But I always feel I've sort of tried to analyze that too. And I'm sure it's linked very strongly to, you know, all these decisions and things when you're buying a business about all the whys and wherefores, because you go, okay, I know that it's going to be easy and start, but there's, to me, it sort of seems to be linked to you want to be able to, why can't it be like something quicker and simpler?
Right.
But you know it's not. And there's this illogical element of frustration that you know shouldn't be there. But I feel in a way it's a bit, I relate very strongly to what you said before about embracing like these other elements, because In the past, my wife and I were talking about that exact point recently. In fact, we've talked about it a few times about going, just embrace this element of, you know, when we're doing this house, that's frustrating. Just embrace and accept that that's going to take X amount of time. It just is. There's no way about it. Nothing is going to happen except like, even if we, some large amount of money, someone comes to the front door and goes, here's like $2 million, which they probably aren't going to do. Even if that happens, these things are still going to take a certain amount of time because then someone starts to do this. Even if they, yeah, let's speed it up. Thank you. Thanks for $2 million. Thank you. And then you can hand it over. But even with that, like, there's certain things that are going to take a certain amount of time. So embrace it and sort of try to enjoy that. And, but it's kind of turning that feeling. I almost feel, I'm not sure exactly how to explain it properly, but I feel like it's the skill of being able to change an emotion into another one, not do a different thing. Right. It's almost like you have to transform it in your mind and somehow into this other thing. And that seems to work for me. I would at this point in time not be able to probably explain that well enough to people to actually help them. But it seems to work for me.
Well, if it works for you, I mean, in part, you know, one of the things that you're talking about and saying is, you know, the ability to take a step back and look at what you have on your plate. And especially when there's a project that's new, I mean, the easiest way, you know, whatever the project is, the oldest formula for success is find someone who's already done it before successfully and copy them, right? That's the oldest proven formula for success. Better yet, get them to mentor you. But so if you look at that in a project, whether it be building a deck or buying a business, it's the recognition, first of all, from the get-go, understanding is you know nothing about this. So if you could find, if you could put your ego aside and recognize, regardless of your degree, and I see it all the time with individuals looking to acquire businesses that have graduate degrees from some of the finest colleges and universities in America, and they, you know, come to us and talk about it, and they're telling me how to buy a business. And I tell them, you know, it's one of these things, with all due respect, you know, that line, with all due respect, there's always an insult coming after that, right? So it's like,
that's
one of these,
right, look, yeah.
Like, it's with all due respect, you may have a very good education, but it doesn't mean you have any knowledge related to this specific project. And so this is all new. And so take a step back, understand you want to break this down into manageable pieces. I had two incidents recently to remind me of that. And one, they're both from, you know, on the buy side, when people acquire the knowledge they need, they can do it. I mean, I've seen it for year after year after year. It happens. Because the first step is getting knowledgeable about something new. But I had two recently. One, I was representing a seller in a transaction. It was a pretty substantial business. And we received the due diligence checklist from the buyer, from the buyer's accountants and the buyer's attorney. And it was a big business. And it had 189 items on this. And my client nearly crapped the bed. Right. Like, it's, oh my God. Like, it's like, I don't have enough time left in my life to be able to get all these things done, and got really panic stricken. When again, it was 189 items, and got everybody on the phone and said, look, guys, first of all, number one, don't panic. Number one. That's the first thing. The second thing is, let's go through the list. Let's only go through the items that you know you can get quickly. Okay. Cause they're not asking you to send men to the moon here. Let's go. There's some of the financial statements, corporate records, bank statement, whatever they do. Let's go through this list of 189 items. From the 189 items, there were 120 of them that they knew they had available already. They either, he might not press a button and have it, but he knew he had it. There was reports, information, who got it, either he or his partner or their chief financial officer would get the information. It was 120. So good, guys, your list has just been reduced by 2/3. So now we're dealing with 60 items. Manageable? Yes. We've got 30 days to produce all of this. Is this manageable? Now we're going to take those 60 items and we're going to allocate them to who's the best person in the company to get the information without disclosing, or getting anybody concerned about the company being sold, or who shouldn't know that the company is being sold. And when we sat there, and after 2 hours on the call, once we banged out these 120 and then allocated the 60, it was like, oh, this is really manageable. No problem. We can get this done. And you know what the final sentence from them was? And it won't take us 30 days. Right. So it's this whole concept of taking a step back. And, the other thing was I had to order a bed. My mother was coming to visit us from Canada, and we have our, you know, a decent sized house. And one of the rooms, when my two girls moved out, I have four kids, but my two girls moved out. My son immediately, I mean, the girls weren't gone for like 12 minutes. He already was converting the room into his own man cave. So, but my mother, I wanted to have a bed set up for her, not just to hide a bed. So I bought this bed, and when it came in, there was 42 pieces, and I think there was about 60 nuts and bolts, but it was 42 pieces. When I was like, what the, are you kidding me? It's like 42. So they said, okay, like the box, it was like barely getting up the stairs. And so, but then it took the box and opened it up and took all the pieces out, matched up the pieces and laid them out in the floor. It's a big room, laid them out on the floor, and then started some, took the instruction sheet, saw what was what, and realized once I had it all laid out, I was actually able to stand back. And in my mind, and I'm reasonably handy, but I'm not that handy. I'm reasonably handy. I could do a little bit of damage, and took a step back and looked at it and said, I could actually see how the bed came together. I still had the parts. They were all over the floor. There was a bag of nuts and screws and bolts and what have you. But outside of that, the main pieces to the sideboard, the under part, the headboard, et cetera, even though the headboard was four different pieces, as I laid it out on the floor and started looking at it, it's like in my mind, I could already see how everything came together. And so you just start piece by piece. And that's the same thing related to, you know, they're really good analogies. And the example that you gave there of the deck, those are, it's similar to this whole process of buying a business. It's difficult. It's not overwhelming. You manage it in bite-sized pieces and you take a step back and you don't panic. You don't treat any incidents as catastrophes. You're walking on the deck, you start putting together and all of a sudden you snap a piece of wood. Well, it's not the end of the world. You just go get another piece of wood. Yeah, it's a bit of a pain in the ass, but it's not the end of the world. You're going to deal with it. If you put the whole deck together, you take one step on it and the whole thing collapses, that becomes more catastrophic. That's no longer an incident. But the majority of things are incidents. Just don't treat them as catastrophes, you know, and you could deal with it one step at a time. And that, you know, I think the process of buying business is very similar to process of anything in life, any new job, new relationship, new kid on the way, buy a new home. It's take a step back, take a deep breath, embrace the uncertainty and go through that as long as you have knowledge on your side. If you're flying by the seat of the pants, okay, and you're just taking it as it comes and just trying to figure out generally, it's not going to work. You want an instruction manual or a blueprint, and then it works real well because someone laid it out for you.
Yeah, no, that's right. Do you find that in that process when you've got all these moving parts that it actually helps to split things into a category? Because when you were describing the bed then too, the first thing that popped into my head, having built way too many bits of furniture in my life from IKEA, various places, way too many to count, that I've always gone, the thing that helps me, I guess this is probably partially from doing websites and other and like apps and various things where you can pile lots of stuff into different categories. So the thing that always helps me is to go, I've got these things and these things. The first thing, if I've got that sort of thing, it just sort of seems to happen naturally now because I have to do it so often, is to go, I'll put all, even if the category isn't something that's a logical one for somebody else, I'll put them into a category. I'll go, these ones like this and these ones like this. So mentally, at least, I can, I guess, partition, you know, things off into sort of elements. And even if it doesn't necessarily help the process and it's not even in the manual, for me, that helps me to see things in less numbers, which is, for me anyway, like seems to help. Is there any application of that sort of idea that you find when you, especially if you've got so many moving parts in?
Absolutely. Yes, it's exactly that actually, because there's 23 steps in the business buying process from the beginning of why buy a business and what to consider right straight through your post purchase priorities. There's 21 in between that, from how to search for the right business, how to get organized, the timing, where to look, how to speak to sellers, visiting the business, negotiation, valuation, due diligence, investigating the industry and the competition. So that's the entire purpose, is you categorize these things. And the one thing that people find, if you had mentioned being a newbie and buying your business, I talk to newbies. That's who I try to, when explaining something, try to make the assumption that this person is a newbie at it. And so what you find is when you do things, when you break them down into proper categories, and the categories are by and large in the right order, right? Because sometimes there's a little bit of pivoting that you have to do, but there's the process follows a logical series of steps. And what happens is, as you start to complete steps along the way, your confidence grows, number one. The second part about it is you start to intuitively understand what has to happen next, because you've already gained, you're already immersed in it. Nothing, as stuff becomes not new, and I don't mean to use the word old instead, when things become not new anymore, there's a level of comfort and confidence and intuitiveness that comes into play, and it seems logical. Now, sometimes, so the whole idea of modules is really, really, really important in this process. Building one upon the other and starting out in the right way. You know, some of the things in our in our world, the statistics are absolutely atrocious. Like 94% of the people who begin to search to buy a business never complete a transaction.
How many, Richard?
94% of the people who begin the search to buy a business never complete a transaction. And the reason why, now I'll give you part of the answer. My clients are 82% succeed in 6 months. And there's one stark difference. The people, the 94, I call them the 90 percenters. What happens is they start out thinking, I want to buy a business. They start looking at business for sale websites. They're all over the place. They start sending in inquiries. They have no idea what question to ask. The broker comes back to them and says, I want you to sign this non-disclosure agreement. They look at it. I'm not signing that. You know, and they just want to, you're just going to send it to my lawyer. And the lawyer says, well, I'm happy to look at it, but it's going to cost you $1,500. And, are you kidding? I'm not spending $1,500. Whereas if they would have just first started out the right way, and if they would have read the non-disclosure agreement line by line and understand that, they'd realize it's a standard document, and for the most part, it's going to repeat itself over and over again at other sellers that you speak with. But instead of going onto the internet, searching endless business for sale listings, trying to figure out which one is right for you, and they're double clicking, and oh, I'll go look at this one, I'll think about that one, I have no idea what questions to ask, how do I know if the numbers are right? And it becomes overwhelming for them. Versus, hey, the first step is you got to get knowledgeable about the whole process, but you got to understand what type of business is right for you. So there's a methodology to do that. You want to pick out a few categories of businesses on those same online business for sale websites. You're going to speak to X number of sellers. So if you pick out four categories and speak with five sellers, you suddenly have a laboratory or a sample size of 20 from which you could start to glean information about what does the seller do every day? What do I like about this business? What I don't like about this business? Does this meet my criteria financially? Enjoyment wise, can I see myself doing this every day? And then you do it like you're on, like you're meditating. It's so much more peaceful because you could do it at a good pace versus this frenzied approach. And then, you know, when you go at something, when you attack something with no blueprint, you scatter your forces. You, it's like this spray and pray strategy, which rarely, if ever, works. And then you become overwhelmed. And then you say, you know what? This is not for me. And so that's why the failure rate is so high. You know, ours and our clients is almost the inverse. And it's just because you do it in this way that's manageable and you acquire the knowledge. So you're ready to deal with things as they come about. Because again, I repeat it, I think we said it twice. This is not difficult. It's just complex. So you have to just manage it into bite sized pieces. What's that old story? How does a mosquito eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, but it's also just one of those like truths. It's like any task. It's like when if you're practicing, you know, I that's in sport too. You know, play squash and things like that. You want to get better. You take a tip. You do one thing at a time. You get a little bit better at that. If you try to do everything, you're never going to be able to do it unless you're like some miraculous sort of person. But like that, but that's probably not going to happen because not, yeah. And I love those stories too, which you do hear like often. And I always, and it sort of gives me a sense of this reminder when you hear these stories from people who have achieved some very high level. And I think I've probably heard it more in sport, but I've also heard it in business too, where people go, look, I wasn't the naturally talented kid. I wasn't the one at some young age who was, you know, excellent and was always excellent. And then someone, you know, saw me and like I was the one who was not very good. And I was just really persistent. And I just had to keep trying and I tried and I tried. And it was because of that that I'm here at this point. And this other common thread too is, you know, it's obviously not everybody, but it's this common thread, but people, then those people seem like a little bit more modest. They've just had to work hard and they've had to like try and they've broken down all the bits, not because they had any like great insight. It was because they were kind of forced into the situation and that's how they had to do it. And it was, and I sort of, I always like those stories because it's just this reminder that those little chipping away bits and pieces, you know, one, you know, like we've been talking about, it's actually easier. So like way easier to do it like that. And it's the logical kind of way to do it. And you break it down and then next thing you know, you're going, oh, actually that's all right. You know, but literally that happens to me almost every day when I go, it really does. Like I go, I'm still terrible at it. And I'm better. But when I have my list of stuff and I go, I'll be able to do that. And then halfway through the day, I go, I will not be able to do that. I'll not be able to do that. Saul, what are you doing? Okay. No worries. Okay. Break it down. Sharp reminder again. Like I'm a bit of a slow learner. I'm a fast learner in certain things, but in other things, I still feel like, oh, well, I'll just accept. I'm probably going to be like this forever. So.
Yeah, well, it's a sign of maturity, right? When you just accept.
I guess so. I guess it is. Something like that.
At least we could say that at this stage, right? I mean, let's just call it maturity.
It's an advantage. It's an advantage.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's also prioritizing certain things. And, you know, I know from my son played very high level ice hockey in the United States and in Northeastern United States. And, I don't think, you know, I've been coaching ice hockey for 40 years. I don't think there's that much to be said for natural talent because it's really disproven that some people are really naturals. I know for him, I remember seeing the light bulb go on when he finally made the connection between practice and results, the amount of time that he put into practice.
That's the connection.
Then when he finally made the connection at about 12 or 13 years old, the light bulb went on because he recognized if I keep practicing a particular move or something with his skating or a shot or whatever in the spare time or during practice or going to the rink, find the extra ice to do it on his own. And somehow that manifests itself and happens in the game. Then they make the connection. And it's similar, you know, in other sports or in life, it's you're getting up. My late partner used to say, you know, it's something, if there's anything they challenge or something you have to deal with, it's like hitting tennis balls. You want to get better at tennis? Just keep smacking tennis balls, right? Keep hitting them. You don't want to hit them wrong way, but you got to keep hitting tennis balls. And it was a very astute observation because it's the truth and it's the persistence. And I've met people in businesses that have been ridiculously successful. If you spend a few minutes talking with them, it's like, my God, how does this person even tie their shoes in the morning? And yet they're ridiculously successful because they found something that works and they were reasonably good at it. And instead of trying to reinvent the wheel or do things differently, they just knew if they keep at it and keep doing this, and looking at better ways to do it even better, and they stuck to it and they stayed focused, that they're ultimately going to get to the promised land. And it's this is not rocket science. It really isn't. It's just, you know, it's just hammering away, just hitting tennis balls.
No, 100%. I mean, one of the things that I play squash, and I mean, one of the things is this thing that I remember, I mean, one of the pros saying in the little help videos that I like to watch and try to improve myself. I'm just saying, like, the best thing literally, you know, well, actually the two best things you can do is to do solo practice and to watch other people play squash. Is just to watch, which I do, and should do more solo practice. But those two things let you learn things in a completely different way that are really beneficial. And I can see a correlation with that and breaking things down, repeating things, because that, whether it's muscle memory or I guess like if you want to call it, I'm sure it's probably got a proper name, but like, you know, that mental muscle memory about
mental reps.
And just repeating things and just going, because you do lose it very quickly too. There was like I had a martial arts instructor years ago who was saying, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I always remember it and it really stuck with me. It was like, there's so many thousands of times, generally this was in relation to getting a kick or a punch or something right. It was like, there's like X amount of thousands of times you have to repeat it for it to become, you know, natural and good when you're doing it the right way for it to become good and become natural, so you don't have to think about it. Some, like, a lot more times. However many thousands.
Oh yeah, I remember. I think it was in Malcolm Gladwell's book talked about. It was like either 10,000 hours or 10,000 times. It was an astronomical number.
Yeah, it was the number.
Yeah,
true. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, it's about 10,000. But then the converse is that to partially or to completely or partially undo that, you have to do it a way less times that are incorrect. So yes. You can
make sense.
Yeah, so you'd be doing. It's very easy to undo it. So the point being that it emphasizes the importance of doing it, not only just doing it, but like doing it the right way, because you can very easily go down a long, like you turn left or right on the street and you want to go home, but like one's a straight line that you can keep going down, and it's going to take you like way out of.
You're right.
Your circuit right out of your to way. Get home, but right. You keep going down it because you think it's the right way. And next thing you know, you're in like, you know, Montreal and you're.
Yeah. Welcome to Montreal.
Yeah, it's like, you speak French? How come you speak French? You know,
and we should parle français. Yeah.
Go home, Englishman. Go home.
Darn Aussie. Yeah. And you know, when I used to coach hockey, and when especially at the higher levels, one of the things you're talking about, the squash and watching other people, one of the most impactful ways to teach people, and we're off the subject a little bit, but when someone was struggling with their game and they made them sit out a game or two, was, you know, just watch the game. Go upstairs from the top of the stands. Yeah. And watch the game. Don't watch it from a standpoint of who's doing what, like not criticism, just watch the game, because sometimes you get so close to it, you're not able to look back and see habits, because people have certain habits during, you know, hockey's a very fast paced game. But, and you see that being done in the pros all the time, where a player gets benched, they sit out a few games, they force them to sit in the press box and watch the game. They're not sitting there having beer and talking to their buddies. They're watching the game and seeing what happens, because sometimes you don't realize your own faults until you see someone else doing it better.
I love, I used to play inline hockey's, because we didn't really have ice hockey really here, but I've always
loved it. Wasn't NHL. It was an NHL game in Australia this year in Melbourne. Two of the teams from the NHL went out to play there.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, years ago, this is probably about 15 or so years ago. I've always loved watching ice hockey. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I used to watch it in like the winter sports all the time. I was like, man, it's such a great game. So I played. We had inline hockey, and
you're right.
So I was the goalie, and it was always so much fun. But it's that very idea of watching versus participating in, like, I remember then too, but then also in squash, like when in the middle of it and someone goes, no, that wasn't, you know, or there was penalty, and you're caught up emotionally and everything, and you go, well, what are you talking about? And the person who's able to be like the third party sitting watching it has this different perspective. But that seems to me, I mean, it happens. It's sort of consistently, it's always like a source of humor too in squash. Like the person scoring is going, no, that's a let or a strike. And the person's like, what are you talking about? But they have this like overview. They have this like physical view on the top, and it's really clear. I mean, it doesn't always mean it's right. Sometimes it's the other way around. It's right, but it's still the point that your perspective is kind of everything. You know, you're in the middle of it. You're feeling, you're next to the person with this, or you're just impartially up. Once again, doesn't mean you're right. Sometimes you're actually completely wrong, but then it's so interesting because two or more people can be looking at exactly the same thing. And yet you know, if we bring that back to like someone buying a business, like someone is, why it's, I guess, like, you know, how they end up responding or reacting to things, you know, is partially influenced or maybe very influenced by why they're selling the business or why they're wanting to buy the business. Is that right? Like someone is like selling the business and they, like in our example, they were selling out of no urgency. There was this really, you know, fluid sort of transition, and you know, thank heavens for us, it was a great experience. I'm sure like there would be many people, there's like urgency and they want to get out and they don't really care that much about, you know, helping the other person, not because they're a nice person, but there's like urgency, right. And they, you know, yes. That would be right, yeah. Wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that people, there are people who don't, you know, there isn't a sense of urgency. That does happen. You know, you want to qualify the individual you're talking to make sure that there is that urgency and motivation, not like a fire sale, not like a liquidation, but that there is the motivation and, you know, that under the right terms and conditions, people are going to sell. You certainly don't want to go down the road with someone and then have an interest in their business. And then they just decided they don't want to sell it. I mean, it happens rarely, but you have to solve for that to make sure that the individual that you're engaged with is serious and committed to the process, because you as a buyer or a prospective buyer are putting in a lot of time, effort, energy, money. You know, bring in professionals, whatever the case may be. And so you want to make sure that the person on the other side of the table is fully committed to it as well. And as a sidebar to that is when the parties are committed, I've always found that if a few things happen, which is the following, if the buyer and seller like and trust each other and the buyer wants to buy and the seller wants to sell, you can't stop them from getting a deal done. They always find a way to get it done.
Yeah.
And so, you know, keeping that motivation level up on both sides is certainly, as you brought up, I mean, it's an important part of the equation.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Is there a, like in your experience with all these different sorts of businesses, have you, and I guess, and any experience with people starting businesses, have you seen any, I guess, distinct, difference in the type of people who, or maybe not the type of people, but a certain approach that people have when they're, say, wanting to start a business from scratch, or then reasons why people want to buy a business? Or is it like I would imagine there'd obviously be a lot of crossover too with people who are are sort of entrepreneurially minded, who are starting businesses from scratch, but also buying businesses. But have you seen, or do you feel that there's some really distinct difference, or are the lines kind of really blurry there?
No, they're not blurry at all. There's certain sectors that lend themselves more for startups. I was on a podcast this morning about leadership that's was done out of Israel, actually, and that's the third most prominent nation in the world for startups. Startups are very common, especially related to the tech industry. We're startups because you're developing something, a concept, an application, a technology, or on the real low end, where very often someone is thinking about a side hustle or a smaller business. Startups make sense in some cases. The failure rate is enormous. I mean, in the United States, I think it's about 80% of the businesses fail in the first 3 years, and then of those that survive, 80% of those fail in the next two. And
yeah, so you're at about that's like in Australia too. I think it's pretty similar. Yeah.
It's probably close, and the delta is probably about the average is about 96%, and it's understandable. There's reasons for it, but you know, mostly lack of capital or the wrong individual. But the beauty of buying unless you know, if someone wants to do some strictly to augment a little bit of income, has their job, you know, that a startup may make sense for them. I'm of the ilk that, you know, when you buy an existing business, you already have gone through that startup phase, right? All that 5 year carnage. You know, a startup, you have nothing. You don't even have paperclips. And it's very easy to think about at the beginning what a startup's going to look like. Oh, yeah, I could dream and hallucinate about here's what the revenues are going to look like, and here's what the expense, and here's what we're going to do. And my experience is that, you know, the sales and revenues happen twice as slow and the expenses are twice as large. And so when you buy an existing business, all of that pain, aggravation, and difficulties related to a startup are gone. You're done. You've passed that 5 year stage. You're going into something where if you do this the right way, you get the keys to the place on Monday. You take a paycheck on Friday. You have revenues. You have customers. You have employees. You have systems. You have processes. You have procedures. You have plans. And so you're starting off. It's like compared to a startup. If you're running a marathon, the startup is starting at the starting gate. The marathon runner is at mile 26. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's, it is. So, you know, to your question, is there a lot of similarities? No, There's none. The difference, the only thing they have in common is they're both businesses. Other than that, they're completely, completely different. For some people think that they find it interesting and romantic and exciting. It's great. I mean, there's something to be learned from them, but certainly if you can afford to look at the initial cost potentially sometimes of an existing business, maybe more, but not in the aggregate, because what you put into a startup, you're going to get to the cost of buying an existing business pretty quickly. And so for someone who wants to replace or generate an income, and especially those who may not even have the confidence related to acquiring businesses or operating them, I mean, the argument isn't even close of how much further ahead that you are by buying an existing business, because you have everything in place. I mean, it's a huge, huge advantage. And the other thing that people consider of business owners, I know when I got into my first business and started growing it and scaling it, I said, shit, this is really hard, right? Like growing this business, and then recognize, and I bought one company at that point and said, you know, my thinking, I adjusted my thinking and said, you know, maybe the way to just grow this is by making these other acquisitions and buying competitive companies and ancillary companies and bolting them onto my company. And even in that regard, it's still so much further ahead versus adding a new initiative to your company, because it's everything is unproven. You don't know, versus you're buying a proven entity. I mean, you could look at historical financials. There's customers in place. So you have a very good idea of what the immediate future is going to look like because you have quantifiable information about the past. And so the two are incomparable.
Yeah. I would imagine too, because like you obviously see from on the big scale, on the bigger scale of things with like the, say like the Facebooks or the Googles or the other big, you know, companies of the world that are acquiring different entities and businesses all the time. I mean, it like from that level down to any other level, I would imagine like only having like very small amount of experience with it, I would imagine that, that there would be also a lot of learning, you know, available too, like in not only from, say, expertise, but if you're, you know, buying a particular business that has got a particular set of strengths with either the people in it or what they do or the market they're in, that's the same industry as you, but they're better at it currently than you are. So acquiring that and these sort of learnings, I would imagine, like from a strategic sort of point of view and a expanding, you know, just off what you were saying about like adding, like value adding things into your business, that would be certainly for some people who are buying businesses would be a big deal. And is it true to say that could be for some people a primary factor in why they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you look at it and say, sometimes you're buying a customer, you're buying a competitor, you're buying their customer list, you may be buying their employees, their brain power. I mean, the goal when you buy, and there's a couple of ways, like I've always looked at building my businesses and buying, wanting to acquire competitors and ancillary products, two different things to look at. So buying competitors, well, I just put someone out of business, right? So that and bring them into my fold, and hopefully I'm able to keep all their employees, etc., but get rid of one competitor. But ancillary business is something complementary, and lose something to the your design and printing business, where all of a sudden you're doing one type of printing, and then you're buying an ancillary business doing digital, or you're buying a company that may have provide a different type of service altogether for the business. So you have all these customers that you're selling design services for, and they say, you know what, I'm going to buy a web design company, or I'm going to buy a digital marketing company or an SEO company, because I could now sell those services to my existing customers. I've always looked at it through that way, saying, okay, I've got this great customer base. I take real good care of my customers. I know they like me because I deliver and we service them well, and we have a good product, and we have a great support team, and we go out of our way to make them happy. So how do I figure out how to buy a company that I can get more stuff to sell to the same customers? Because it's much easier to sell an existing client than it is to go out and get a new client.
Yes.
And so I've always looked at it from a standpoint from ancillary businesses. How can I sell them more? Like if you were looking at it for in home services business, someone who might be in landscaping and tree trimming, they may look at it and say, well, maybe we should buy an alarm company, or maybe we should buy a pest control company, or maybe we should buy a pressure cleaning company, because we can go to the same clients that we already have.
Yeah,
they're
like
already
a symbiotic
doing business with us. Yes.
They have like a symbiotic relationship automatically.
Exactly. And you can sell them, you can sell more stuff to the same people. So that's it's a very, very logical and proven way to explode your business.
Yeah, totally. As we're getting, I guess, towards the end of the podcast, I just want to ask you sort of a business related, but also personal question. I saw on your website, you were talking about that you sold your first business, or you had your first business and then sold it when you were about 12. And I was really curious as to what that business was. And I thought straight away, I hope Richard says it's like a lemonade stand, but
no, it was bigger. What happened was, it's great. It's my favorite story, favorite business I ever sold, because I lived in a small town north of Montreal. And on Sunday, there were newspapers every day, unlike today. But on Sunday, there was a newspaper you have to go to the store to buy. And it was called the Sunday Express. It wasn't delivered to the house. And people who bought the newspaper had to go to the local convenience store or whatever to buy the paper. My dad included would send me there when it freeze my butt off in the winter, but I had to go up and get him the paper. And I thought, I was 12 years old, said, this is sort of ridiculous. I went to the newspaper itself and said, why don't you allow me to do home delivery? They didn't have home delivery. Why don't you allow me to do home delivery? I'll bring it right to the people. I'll get these subscribers and they'll do it. And sure enough, they agreed with this 12-year-old punk to do it. And I built it up to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of households that I was delivering these papers. It got so big. The papers used to sell for 15 cents a piece and I used to get 2 cents a piece plus the tips. And it was nice because, you know, the denomination of coins in Canada was a quarter, was 25 cents. So when it was 15 cents a paper, people used to give you a quarter. I got a 10 cents tip. The problem was then the price of the newspaper went up to 20 cents and people were still giving me the same quarter. So now my profit was dropping in half because I was only getting a nickel in the tip because they weren't giving me 30 cents. So I took these hundreds of households that I had. And I said, I'll keep a few to myself that are in the immediate area of my house. Okay. So it'll be pretty easy. And I'm going to get all these other neighborhood kids and I'm going to give them each a route and I'm going to let them have it. And with the deal that I made with them was, hey, listen, you can keep the tips, right? You get 5 cents on every paper because most people give you a quarter, cost 10 cents. I made my money on the 2 cents that the newspaper itself paid. So under my umbrella, I was getting 2 cents from all their papers, right? Yeah. And, you know, I was making like 20 bucks a week. I was 12 years old. This is 1973. I mean, I was the kid. I was the kid. My tips of my own papers was about $5 a week. So I was the kid walking around with 25 bucks in his pocket when the average family paid their kid an allowance of 25 cents. So, like, I was like a big wig. And, I loved it. It was great. And it exploded quickly.
I love that story.
And so I always say I bought started my first business at 12 and sold it profitably at 13. And that was, I guess, in some ways the genesis for my entrepreneurial life. And there's some days, let me tell you, there's some days I'd really like to go back and just be delivering papers.
I think that's a whole
different subject.
Maybe you can, like in a different way. Because the principle, I mean, it's like the principle is the same as a lot of things, isn't it?
It was a lot of hard work. I mean, I was up really early Sunday morning, 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I remember when I used to carry these newspapers. And I remember the one day I got up and I'd left my, I used to put the two bags on my shoulder. And then it got impossible. I had to make back and forth trips, but I used to two bags on my shoulder and drive around and put the newspapers on, toss the newspapers or deliver them. But I remember, I got up one morning, I couldn't find my bike. And I realized I left my bike outside overnight and someone stole my bike.
Oh,
and
no.
I was just like, oh my God, I got to carry these, right? I got to carry these papers, right? And then, and it was the same thing in the winter. I'd put them on, we call it a toboggan, which was like a sled, a wood sled. And you'd load up the papers on that and you'd drag it around because Montreal got a good whack of snow all the time. But sometimes I'd get up on Sunday mornings, it would be like 2 feet of snow and you'd have to carry the, pull the toboggan through and deliver the papers. But the good thing about the 2 feet of snow is we used to shovel snow for money. And so people couldn't get their cars out. So you could really charge them a good buck to make some
money. Oh, that's fantastic. So you created your own like value add there anyway.
Own value add. My buddy and I, Brian and I, man, we used to go neighbor to neighbor and like on a good snowstorm, we could make ourselves a good whack of money in the course of a day, especially some days got snowed out, called school days. They were canceled school days because too much snow. So we didn't have to go to school anyways, Sunday or otherwise. And we could shovel till like 3-4 in the afternoon and then go to the park and play ice hockey with a relative bag of cash in our pockets.
Had a value add then too. Even though you probably didn't realize it at the time, you were
actually... I didn't. Now it's all making sense to me now.
Yeah. I mean, I see then straight away, I was like, kids are doing this, pulling a toboggan. That's hard work. Like you're getting really physically fit, probably. You're fit anyway because you're like a kid, but like physically fit, like you're pulling this toboggan around, then you're shoveling snow. I was like, that's hard work. You're doing that all the time. And the advantage that would have had that you were probably completely... oblivious to was it would have probably, helped your ice hockey and it would have been.
Yes. Yes. Helped the leg strength. Yeah. I didn't even think about it. Helped the leg strength. And I guess it's sort of like some of that entrepreneurial spirit. So I'm glad you brought it up. They're great memories. It was a lot of fun. And, I think it's why it's so important for young people to say the earlier possible to have jobs and have some responsibility and accountability and productivity because you learn a lot. It's a very, very tiny thing relative to jobs that you may have or businesses you may own, but you learn that responsibility again early on and the enjoyment from, hey, I did this, I got paid that, and it's and I think people generally feel pretty good when they have a few bucks in their pocket.
Yeah, yeah. I think as a small side note, having stories like that in retrospect to tell is great too. There's wonderful sort of power to having a good story, I think, and
well,
that's
thank you.
Yeah. And that's a wonderful story. I saw that straight away. I was like, my mind was like swimming. I was like, what was it? What was he doing? And then I didn't. And yeah. And I thought, I was like, oh, please let it be like a lemonade stand, just like some silly cliche, and then you're.
No, it wasn't. I'm proud to say it wasn't. I had those too, but this was legit.
That's great. So, so just as we're sort of at the tail end, could you share with everyone, please, Richard, some sort of quote either from yourself or quote that you really like that doesn't necessarily have to relate, but something that you'd like to share with everyone?
Sure. I have my, you can't see it now, but my wall in front of me. I have quotes galore in this thing because I find them motivational, helpful. And there's some that I have on my own or whatever, but there's one I was actually thinking about this the other day, which is this comes from this guy. His name was Colby Cave. He was a 26-year-old young man in Canada. He was a hockey player when he died at 26, young guy. I believe it was a brain bleed or a brain aneurysm, but he was a professional hockey player, played for the Edmonton Oilers. And there's a quote that I have in front of my desk that I always thought was really, really wonderful, which is he said, "Be somebody that makes everybody feel like a somebody." And I've always thought that that's, it's always resonated with me because I think it helps control sometimes your normal reaction to certain life events or especially as it relates to relationships or people, that may need some mentorship or guidance or employees when you talk to them, when there's a tendency to maybe point out things that they've done wrong versus talking about some good things are presented in a way you could always deliver harsh news in a good way. It's still harsh news, but you can deliver it in a respectful, kind and thoughtful way. And so that's, I've always thought that to be a terrific quote. And it was, I believe it was his wife when after he passed away, she talked about that. So for me, be somebody that makes everybody feel like a somebody, I think is just a terrific guiding principle and quote.
I agree. Yeah. No, that's a great, I've never heard that one before. That's a nice, it's also the language used too is quite sort of unquote, like there's a lot of flowery quotes, which are great, but that's a nice sort of grounded quote. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it gets to the point pretty quick. Yeah. You get it. Yeah. You get it. I love it. That's the one that sits front and center. straight above, looking at your handsome face is straight above that. I could see that all the time. Cause yeah, I think it's pretty, you get it.
Yeah. No. And could you also just tell everyone before we wrap up the best way online, if people want to, after listening to the podcast, they want to learn more about you and about what you do, where do they go online? What's the best location?
Well, after an hour and a half together, if they're not sick of me and they still want to learn more, the easiest place to go is richardparker.com. Again, it's richardparker.com. Yep. And we have hundreds of free articles and reports and everything and anything related to buying a business. So to learn more about me and certainly if they want to get in touch with me or have any questions, I'm happy to answer anything, can help anybody with, maybe struggling with things that decisions they have to make. But that'd be the best place. Go to richardparker.com.
Thanks, Richard. It's been a real pleasure. It's a great conversation. And thanks so much for sharing all different stories and knowledge. I'm sure, I hope people listening got a lot out of it too. Have you got anything else just before we sign off that you'd like to share?
You know, I've been doing this for so many years and I've seen different levels of success. I always like to tell people that if you have any interest or inkling or entrepreneurial spirit running through your blood, even if you don't know what it is exactly, but you have any inkling to want to try to do this, then I just think that people owe it to themselves to at least learn about it.
Yeah.
To at least learn what's involved, because you just don't want to go. I know it's typical. You don't want to go through your whole life not doing it or regrets, but it's not that difficult. I'm a dumb guy from Canada with no university degree. I've bought 14 companies and a co-investment over $200 million. I could assure you, like I'm definitely not the sharpest tool in the shed. I happen to know this stuff really well, but if I can do it, anybody can do it. And so I really think that people they owe it to themselves to at least find out what it's about. And do some good learning and then decide whether or not they want to do it.
Thank you. Thanks, Richard. That's great.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. It's nice talking with an Aussie. I enjoy it. I like your observations and you have some great stories as well. So I'm sure your listeners are very loyal and love hearing your background. And I'm sure you got 1,000 other ones. So that's interesting. And I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, no, thanks, Richard. And so with that in mind, that's actually it for today, everyone. Thanks so much again for listening into the Greater Business Podcast. And we will see you again soon. Say goodbye, Richard.
Bye, Richard.
See ya.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business Podcast.